Peter B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, the final day of September 2020. The heat of impeachment is being felt by Trump and his allies. And I see almost all Republicans hunkered down in fear, afraid that if they cross Trump, he will tweet them into oblivion, and afraid that if they don't, they may lose their jobs at a future election. And the Democratic strategy of focusing on the recently emerged Ukraine scandal as the central focus for impeachment continues to be problematic. This is going to be a long struggle. And Team Trump has fired the initial salvo in its counterattack, releasing a TV ad today that is hard-hitting, and while it is based on projection, taking Trump's vulnerabilities and projecting them onto Joe Biden, well, Biden has given them enough to work with, as we will detail in today's podcast. But first, and there's a link to it if you want to watch and get all the images, but I will just play you the audio track of this new Trump campaign commercial.
Joe Biden promised Ukraine $1 billion if they fired the prosecutor investigating his son's company.
If the prosecutor's not fired, you're not getting the money. Oh, son of a bitch. Got fired.
But when President Trump asks Ukraine to investigate corruption, the Democrats want to impeach him, and their media lapdogs fall in line. They lost the election. Now they want to steal this one. Don't let them.
I'm Donald Trump, and I approve this message.
Now, there's a lot of spin, a lot of outright lies in this commercial. But, you know, political commercials are not subject to any kind of fact-checking. He can say whatever he wants. And this is the impression that Fox News viewers, that Trump's Twitter followers, the people who show up in MAGA hats at the mob rallies around the country, they're going to nod their heads. And I heard Rush Limbaugh this morning as I drove to the secret studio, and he's busy fabricating the case of Trump as a victim. Now, in some ways, this is comical, and in some ways, it is just truly tragic. But as I view this skirmish, I see losers on both sides. So today, Trump took to Twitter, and he hammered Adam Schiff, chair of the House Intelligence Committee, which is going to be the lead dog in the Democratic impeachment train, at least for now. He wrote, "Representative Adam Schiff illegally made up a fake and terrible statement, pretended it to be mine as the most important part of my call to the Ukrainian president, and read it aloud to Congress and the American people. It bore no relationship to what I said on the call. Should he be arrested for treason?" In another tweet, he said his lies were made in perhaps the most blatant and sinister manner ever seen in the Great Chamber. He wrote down and read terrible things, then said it was from the mouth of the President of the United States. Now, obviously, Trump is being melodramatic here. And this is his tactic. Just as he pursued Robert Mueller with daily tweets, Adam Schiff is the new lucky guy. Only Schiff invited this attack. It is ridiculous what Schiff said. He was essentially paraphrasing the call summary issued by the White House. And by the way, I still maintain that call summary doesn't cover a call that was allegedly 30 minutes long. Anyway, Schiff was paraphrasing and kind of using his own language to describe Trump's exchange with President Zelensky. And where, you know, he substituted language, he did add elements that were untrue. And he should have known that a broadside like this would be coming. And Adam Schiff is generally careful. He is generally fairly circumspect in his comments. But this kind of activity is what gives Trump a place to land a blow. Now one of the few modest defectors as the GOP hunkers down is Tom Bossert. He served as Trump's Homeland Security Advisor early in the administration. He was squeezed out by John Bolton. And while he doesn't believe that these are impeachable offenses, he said he was deeply disturbed that Trump tries to get Zelensky to produce damaging information about Democrats. And Bossert is rare as a Republican who would say, look, and this is his view, not mine, it is completely debunked, he said, related to the claims that the Ukrainians were behind some of the early moves that led to Russiagate going back to 2016. Now, I don't particularly agree with this view or this assessment, but Bossert said, well, it is completely debunked. I am frustrated, deeply frustrated with what he and the legal team is doing and repeating that debunked theory to the president. It sticks in his mind when he hears it over and over again. And for clarity here, George, he's talking to Stephanopoulos on ABC. Let me just again repeat that it has no validity. It's a bad day and a bad week for this president and for this country if he is asking for political dirt on an opponent. But it looks to me like the other matter that's far from proven is whether he was doing anything to abuse his power and withhold aid in order to solicit such a thing. Now, is his equivocation an effort to avoid the worst of Trump's wrath? I don't know. But he, Bossert, and a guy named Adam Kinzinger, who's a congressman from Illinois, plus, there is one Republican House member from Nevada who have said things that are critical of the president's behavior, but they come up short from embracing the Democrats' route to impeachment here. And that is it. Mitt Romney in the Senate appears to be the only one, and there are rumors that he hopes Trump goes down in flames and he would jump into the presidential race in 2020 if that occurred. And former Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona, I believe he has spoken up, but we are not seeing any Republican defectors at this point. And Nancy Pelosi, who is the speaker and designated Schiff as the leader of this phase of the impeachment, sidelining Judiciary Chairman Jerry Nadler. Well, Nadler, as I've explained, I've interviewed him many times, maybe four or five, I guess. And he's a humorless guy who is relentlessly on message. He is very careful with what he says. Now, Schiff doesn't have a sense of humor either, but he tends to get caught up in the drama of the moment and the rosy glow that he appears under when he's on Rachel Maddow's show on almost a weekly basis, if not more often. Now, Schiff says that the whistleblower from the CIA will be coming to a closed session very soon, but the whistleblower's lawyer says that no date or time has been set so far. So the corporate media is in overdrive. The New York Times published a front-page story on Sunday called A Shadow Foreign Policy Backfires on the President. We'll delve into that in a second. But their Week in Review, the Sunday Review section, has a front-page editorial. The headline reads this way, "The allegations are grave. An election is at risk. The founders were clear. The only option." So they are all in. They are going full blast with the Democrats on Ukraine gate as the basis of impeachment. And they make strong arguments. They make some caveats. Yes, this could. Let me read this part. It is quite possible, though by no means assured, that an impeachment inquiry will produce political benefits for Trump. He and many of his supporters draw energy and a sense of purpose from conflict. They relish defining themselves in opposition to enemies real and imagined. Further, weary of bickering in Washington and anxious about paying for health care or housing or schooling or whatever, many Americans may choose to tune out. So, as I decipher the Democratic strategy here, it is to try to force a quick resolution by bringing up articles impeachment as soon as November and forcing the Senate to hold a trial. And McConnell has said he will not duck that before the end of the year. So are they acknowledging they don't have the votes in the Senate? This will merely be a show trial to demonstrate to some voters that Trump is deeply corrupt and should not be reelected? Maybe. But the way Trump affects the news cycle and Americans' short-term memory, something that happens in December of 2019 will be ancient history by November of 2020. So you can tell I remain puzzled by the Democratic strategy. So to Sunday's New York Times, they wrote a lengthy story with three different writers. They authored a timeline, which is somewhat helpful in seeing how these events unraveled and seeing how far back Rudy Giuliani's efforts in Ukraine go. It is at least to January of this year. So it's not a single phone call, not a single action that informs this. And the cover-up does appear to be significant. The efforts to bury the Ukraine phone call memo on a super-secured computer where only top secret information is held. And it raises questions, as we'll delve into a little later, about what else may have been inappropriately stored on that special computer server. On Friday, Kurt Volker, State Department Special Envoy for Ukraine, the guy who set up meetings in Ukraine for Rudy Giuliani, the guy who Giuliani said essentially was his State Department minder, who Giuliani says authorized his actions in Ukraine. Now, this is bullshit. There is no paper. There's no public information that Giuliani had any special instructions from the State Department to conduct his investigations in Ukraine on behalf of Trump. And this is what involves Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, in potential impeachment investigations. And it also relates to the recall of the U.S. ambassador, who was not playing ball with Giuliani and the Trump team. Now, I have excoriated the corporate media in recent weeks for repeatedly exonerating Joe and Hunter Biden without providing any detail. And I will acknowledge that the Washington Post on September 28th published a lengthy story called "The Gas Tycoon and the Vice President's Son, the Story of Hunter Biden's Foray into Ukraine." And while the details in this story mostly back up the broad claims of exoneration of criminal activity by Joe or Hunter Biden, when you go through the history and when Hunter Biden was placed on the board of Burisma shortly after the Maidan Revolution, fueled by the United States, backed by the Obama administration, suddenly, the vice president's son gets an offer to serve on a board that only meets twice a year. He has no background in energy. He's, you know, had no dealings of note in Ukraine before this. And so even the Washington Post has to acknowledge, after it exonerates both of them, that the optics of this, that the nepotism, are stinky. And they wrap it up in the family history, and we know that Hunter was the one who survived that car accident that killed his mother and sister and his brother, Beau. But they do note honestly that Hunter Biden had a stint as a K Street lobbyist while his father was senator. They don't mention his service on the Amtrak board. That's readily available if you look at the Wikipedia bio of Hunter Biden. Then they note that he got hired at David Boy's law firm. One of his investment company partners had just joined the board of Burisma. So Hunter got his own invitation. And this was to cover for the problems encountered by the guy who founded Burisma. Yeah, I don't have his lengthy Russian name in front of me here. I'll get to it probably. Oh, here it is, Lokhevsky. You know, he had his own problems navigating the revolution, the coup. And so he thought that by putting a prominent American name on his board of directors, that he would look better. Now, the Post often also teases out comments from unnamed former staffers to Joe Biden who warned him that this didn't look good, but Joe brushed them off. And John Kerry's stepson, Chris Hines, he carries the name of the ketchup empire, he refused to join the board of Burisma. He said it was a bad idea, and it was so bad that he broke up his business partnership with Hunter Biden and Devin Archer, who did join the board and I believe is still there today. So in a moment, I have details from both of the prosecutors, Yuri Lutsenko and Viktor Shokin from Ukraine. But this Washington Post story quotes Shokin telling the Post that he believes he was ousted in March of 2016 because he was investigating Burisma. If he'd been allowed to remain in the job, he would have questioned Hunter Biden's qualifications to be a board member, noting this person had no work experience in Ukraine or in the energy sector. Now, over at the Atlantic magazine, Sarah Chase gets a little more aggressive. Her headline reads, Hunter Biden's Perfectly Legal, Socially Acceptable Corruption. And while she repeats the generalized exonerations of the Bidens, and she notes that she believes that Trump has done some bad shit here, she goes on to say, well, what is this here? Let's start with Hunter Biden, she writes. In April 2014, he became a director of Burisma, the largest natural gas producer in Ukraine. He had no prior experience in the gas industry, nor with Ukrainian regulatory affairs, his ostensible purview at Burisma. He did have one priceless qualification, his unique position as the son of the Vice President of the United States, Ukraine's most crucial ally. Weeks before Biden came on, Ukraine's government had collapsed. Oh, I love this. Amid a popular revolution. No, it was a U.S.-backed coup where we employed neo-Nazis to help foment the takedown of Yanukovych. Anyway, she writes further, there was already a template for how insiders in a gas-rich kleptocracy could exploit such a crisis, using Western advisors to facilitate and legitimate their plunder. And that was used in the Soviet Union as it transitioned to Russia. And lots of Americans went there to make some money. Later in the article, she writes, Hunter Biden was hardly the only prominent American who did well for himself. Kofor Black, George W. Bush's CIA counterterrorism chief, cashed in. Paul Manafort, we know about that. Former Democratic White House counsel, Gregory Craig. Don't forget Tony Podesta, former Republican Congressman Vin Weber. And others. And she correctly states here, when prominent Americans leverage their global reputations for financial gain, they attract almost no attention today. How many of us who consider ourselves well-versed in U.S. politics know that alongside her consulting firm, former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright started an emerging markets hedge fund run by her son-in-law? Well, that's just one of many stinky relationships that former elected and appointed officials have taken on. I also am informed by Yasha Levine, who's been a guest on this program many times. He is a Russian emigre who grew up here in San Francisco. And he says, it looks like there's a concerted effort in the press to shrink time and space and make it seem like the only truly bad Ukrainian meddling started and stopped with Donald Trump and his cronies. And he says the Times, the New York Times, has been leading the charge. Journalists like Ken Vogel had previously reported on Democratic Party operatives shopping around for dirt on Trump's people in Ukraine, and who had himself investigated Joe Biden and sons meddling there, now sidelines his own work as some sort of Trumpian conspiracy theory. In other words, Levine says the whitewashing has begun. It goes deeper than even Joe Biden or the DNC or the 2016 election. The truth is that America's been meddling and messing with Ukraine so persistently for so many years that no one thinks there's anything wrong with it. It's been the normal way of doing things. That's why Biden sat around yuck-yucking at the Council on Foreign Relations, bragging that he had gotten the prosecutor fired. Oh, and Levine has more. Over the past few decades, America, its allies, and its institutions have meddled in Ukraine in ways big and small. They helped craft Ukraine's privatization laws. They funneled endless amounts of cash into two color-type revolutions, the Orange Revolution in 2004, then Maidan's Revolution of Dignity in 2014. They've handpicked leaders of the government and secretly threatened to jail oligarchs. They've forced Ukraine to cut its budget. These weren't just general suggestion, but a hands-on micromanaging of the economy in return for aid and investment. And on Friday, the International Monetary Fund delayed payments to Ukraine that they desperately need because of the ongoing corruption. One more quote from Levine. For years, America and its allies have leveraged and magnified this instability. They've worked with oligarchs and backed one clan against another in an attempt to destabilize the country and peel it away from Russia's sphere of influence, all while turning Ukraine into a fertile source of plunder, contracting opportunities, lobbying gigs, foundation support, nonprofit donations, cushy corporate board seats, and all the other perks that America's political elite get for managing the empire. Now, I want to quote to you from a witness statement from the former Ukraine General Prosecutor Viktor Shokin. And what is explained here is that there is another form, another episode of direct interference in the affairs of Ukraine by Vice President Joe Biden. And it related to the return to Ukraine of a controversial figure named Dmitry Firtash. And Firtash's return was opposed by Poroshenko and by Joe Biden. And when Shokin told them that he did not have anything to prosecute Dmitry Firtash for, well, they said, never mind, we will get the U.S. Justice Department to indict him, and we'll arrest him that way. So they were planning to arrest this man, Firtash, if he returned. They shut down airspace to private jets. They, government organized and endorsed a unit of ultra-right militia of the Azov Battalion, that's the neo-Nazis, to threaten Firtash by posting pictures of military-clad, armed members of the unit wearing masks and patrolling the airport waiting for Firtash to arrive. So he directly fingers Joe Biden as a key player in making Poroshenko ban this guy Firtash from returning. About his exit as the prosecutor, he writes or states, "The truth is I was forced out because I was leading a wide-ranging corruption probe into Burisma Holdings, a natural gas firm active in Ukraine, and Joe Biden's son Hunter was a member of the board of directors. I assume Burisma, which was connected with gas extraction, had the support of the U.S. Vice President because his son was on the board of directors. It was Poroshenko. He was emphatic that I should cease my investigations regarding Burisma. Later, it was Biden's order and wish that I be removed from office, not Poroshenko's decision. He submitted to the demands of state officials from the administration of President Obama." Now, this is very damaging. This flies in the face of the broad exonerations that the corporate media has made about Biden's role in the dismissal of Viktor Shokin as the prosecutor general there. Then we get a statement from an interview by the LA Times with Yuri Lutsenko. And he plays both sides of the game here. He says, look, I did not find anything criminal of the actions of Biden, son, and father. But, he said, I was willing to investigate it when Rudy Giuliani came calling, but I said, let's put this through prosecutors, not through presidents. I told him I could not start an investigation just for the interests of an American official. Well, if he's referring to Giuliani, Giuliani was not an official in any way, shape, or form. Lutsenko said that he met Rudy twice in person, had numerous phone conversations with him, and he did say that Hunter Biden's position on the board could be signs of a conflict of interest, but was not illegal under Ukraine law. He also references Kurt Volker, who resigned as special U.S. envoy, as I mentioned, on Friday, after the whistleblower account alleged that Volker had set up some of Giuliani's meetings with Ukrainian officials. So it's a real mixed bag. And this is why I argue that the Democrats are pursuing impeachment on the wrong road. This can blow up in their faces. Trump has the latitude to declassify much of this information, and he could declassify the details of U.S. covert backing of the coup against Yanukovych in 2014. I believe this leaves Joe Biden as toast. And I also fear, as I've said, that this can backfire on the Democrats. I want to share with you two interesting views from former intelligence community whistleblowers who I respect. Russ Tice blew the whistle at the NSA. He's the one who courageously told us about the domestic wiretaps on political leaders, including Obama and U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein, Supreme Court judges and nominees. And Tice wrote that he had used the Intelligence Community Whistleblower Protection Act when he originally went public. And he believes that the intelligence community is using this episode to try to eject Trump, to likely eject Biden from being a contender for president next year, and to eviscerate the Whistleblower Protection Act. He writes, "Has anyone thought of the possibility that this use of the whistleblower law was not a political hack job against either the right or left, but rather the heart of the intelligence community making a play to rid of itself of a very limited, yet still very pesky mechanism that allows real intelligence offer whistleblowers the legal means to go to Congress with criminal and unconstitutional acts being committed by the agencies they work for? When I invoked the ICWPA, NSA fought tooth and nail to keep me from taking it from talking to intel committees on the Hill. There are very few of these complaints because there are no protections in the act to keep the intelligence officer from retaliation being leveled against them by the agency he or she works for. And this is the most critical issue. I do want to respect this whistleblower. And if he does not want to be unmasked, he should not be. But I think it's inevitable that his identity will be revealed. And Russ may have a very important point there. Meanwhile, John Kiriakou, who spent 30 months in federal prison because he admitted that the CIA had tortured people, he gave a great interview to Kevin Gostola. You can hear it at shadowproof.com. A couple of quotes from John. "I think the Democrats in the House have gotten a little bit ahead of themselves. I'm not sure that what we have here is an impeachable offense yet. I think it remains to be seen. It certainly warrants an investigation." And he said, you know, when I blew the whistle, my chain of command created the torture program. So I couldn't go through them and say, hey, I think every one of you guys is committing a war crime or a crime against humanity. So I want you to report yourselves. That's not going to work. And I couldn't go to the oversight committees because they were implicated in the creation of the torture program. Then he talks about Tom Drake, the NSA whistleblower, who did go through his chain of command and wound up being charged under the Espionage Act. And he also has critical comments about the New York Times offering partial information about the current whistleblower. And he says, look, he didn't go to the media like I or Dan Ellsberg did or Ed Snowden. He wanted to maintain his privacy and do the right thing at the same time. There's a legal definition of whistleblowing, that is, bringing to light any evidence of waste, fraud, abuse, illegality, or threats to the public health and public safety. Anybody with a conscience is going to want to do that, but at the same time, the person deserves anonymity. He also goes on to say that Adam Schiff is no friend of whistleblowers, plain and simple. Danny Serson, who was our guest on a podcast interview last week, I highly recommend his commentary to you. He referenced a piece that he was writing at the time of our interview. It's been published at Truthdig, and I've linked to it in the show file for today's podcast. And he says you should impeach Trump, and if you do that, you should impeach Obama and Bush. And why stop there? Impeach the military-industrial complex and the venal corporate arms dealers, the merchants of death. Impeach the revolving door generals like Jim Mattis. Impeach yourselves, Congress. Strong argument, somewhat fantastical, we can say. The polls are not surging, but they are ticking up in favor of impeachment. 55% now they say they agreed that the act exposed of Trump's phone call and the related matters merit an impeachment inquiry. 42% of Democrats say that Trump already deserves impeachment. 42% of the public, 75% Democrats, 16% Republicans. And 35% of independents think that it's too soon to weigh in on that question. But they do acknowledge that it's a very serious or somewhat serious problem. Dahlia Withlick, who is a great legal mind and a strong writer at Salon, Slate, I gave the wrong outlet there. She's a big booster of Russiagate. I still respect her intellect. And she wrote a piece that raises important questions about whether the Trump administration has buried other phone calls and whether they prevented St. Bob Mueller from accessing phone call records like or meeting records like the one with Kislyak and other Russians on the day after they had fired the FBI director, James Comey. And, of course, for me, I have a very different interpretation. It's another example of the way St. Bob Mueller conducted a limited hangout investigation. Oh, and get this. Joe Biden's campaign staff, including Anita Dunn, she worked for Obama, and then she worked for TransCanada, selling us the Keystone XL pipeline. Well, they are demanding that the media impose a blackout on Rudy Giuliani because he is spreading false, debunked conspiracy theories on behalf of Donald Trump. That's a big mistake. Now, it shows how much they fear what even an idiot and a caricature like Rudy Giuliani, a self-caricature, might be able to blurt out on a live television interview. And I do think the media has an obligation. They should record interviews with Rudy Giuliani and edit out his bullshit. But they don't, because they love the fight. They like the skirmish. They like the phony controversy that is being generated because it gets ratings. There is a little bit of other news today. Last week, a federal judge dismissed an American journalist lawsuit challenging his alleged placement on a kill list by American authorities in Syria. And it's after the Trump administration invoked that ugly state secrets privilege. District Judge Rosemary Collier last year had opened the way for an American journalist, Bilal Abdul Karim, who grew up in New York, to look for answers in his civil case and to try to clear his name because he says that five different times he has nearly been killed by U.S. airstrikes in Syria. And Collier had said a year ago that Abdul Karim had a constitutional right to due process in court. But that has been quashed, squashed, and eviscerated by the unfounded state secrets privilege. And finally today, it's with mixed emotions that I acknowledge the passing of Joseph C. Wilson. Joe Wilson was a hero in 1992, when he was the last diplomat out of Baghdad. Joe Wilson was a hero in 2002, when he wrote the op-ed about his trip to Niger where there was no yellow cake, as George W. Bush had claimed in his State of the Union message. I met Joe Wilson on several occasions. I interviewed him half a dozen times. And I'm sorry that he passed away, and I offer my condolences to his ex-wife, Valerie Plame, their children, and his adult kids, who I met one time. But the mixed emotions are that after 2008, Joe Wilson and his then-wife, Valerie, I learned from the obit that they divorced last year, and you probably know she's running for Congress in New Mexico. But in 2008, Wilson and Plame did a TV commercial endorsing Hillary Clinton, and that's their right. But they were compensated for that. When Joe, who was a consultant to a Texas-based energy company, collaborated with Stuart Blumenthal, who had unusual access to Hillary Clinton, he was sending her detailed emails every day almost, while he was being paid $10,000 a month by the Clinton Foundation. And Stu Blumenthal was looking for business opportunities. He approached several in Libya after we took out Gaddafi. But around 2009 or 2010, Joe Wilson and Stu Blumenthal persuaded Hillary Clinton to sign off on a loan guarantee for the Texas company to build an electrical power plant in Tanzania. The amount was over $60 million. And we learned about this not from emails that came from WikiLeaks or the Russians, but from court documents, because Joe Wilson had to sue the Texas Energy Company because they hadn't paid his consulting fees. He was due a big bonus for delivering the pork. And I consider that to be a sordid deal. And for me, it stains the heroic aspects of Joe Wilson's history. Thanks for listening to my news and comment podcast today. You're free to share it far and wide. You'll find it on the YouTube machine. And I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails.